David Wolford with Todd Hollenbach in Louisville, Kentucky on June 14th, 2006. Mr. Hollenbach, how are you?
Doing good.
Okay, why don't you just kind of introduce yourself, and we'll get into the purpose of the interview. But just give us a little bit about your background, where you went to school. I think you grew up here in Louisville, correct?
I'm a fifth generation Kentuckian. My mama's people came to Kentucky in the 1840s. My daddy's people came here in the late 1860s. So we've been here a long time. I was born and reared in Louisville. Went to Sacred Heart Model School, then went to Holy Spirit Grade School. Was in the first graduating class of Trinity High School in 1957. Left Trinity and went to the University of Notre Dame, following in my dad's footsteps. Mm-hmm. And then I graduated from the Brandeis School of Law at the University of Louisville.
And what was your, when did you decide to go into law and eventually politics? What caused you to want to do that?
Well, I always had an interest in the law, but my mother's family was quite politically active. Mother's first cousin was married to Governor Lawrence Wetherby. And so that side of, she was an O'Meara, but that Irish side of the family was the very politically active mm-hmm. part of the family. My dad's people, I would have been fourth generation in the distillery business had my grandfather not sold the distillery, the old Glencoe Distillery. They always said that my daddy's side of the family made all the whiskey and my mama's Irish side of the family drank it all. But that's pretty much the historic background. Of my family.
Okay. And what was your first campaign into politics?
When did I first run? I ran and was elected county judge of Jefferson County in 1969.
That was your first race that you actually entered?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
What did you do right before that?
I was a trial lawyer.
Private practice or?
Private practice.
Okay.
I began my practice with a law firm by the name of Marshall, Cochran, Hayburn, and Wells, which was a large, prominent law firm here in Louisville. And I was with them and ran, I graduated from law school in 65.
Did that evolve into Brown, Todd, Hayburn? Or
it did.
Now it's Frost, Todd, Brown?
That's
okay.
Correct.
I've got a friend that works for them in the Lexington office and one in Cincinnati. Now, I mainly asked to talk to you because of your relevance as county judge of Jefferson County. You were in your, second term. You won your second race when the school desegregation order came down and the busing started. So that's what I would like to just kind of gear our discussion toward that. But what involvement, if any, did you have in the desegregation lawsuit? Let's start prior to Judge Gordon's plan. You know, before there was ever a distinct federal order that there would be desegregation, you were county judge by that point. Did you have any kind of involvement on that, or did you just kind of watch from the outside to see what was going to happen?
Well, Dave, you have to keep in mind that the county judge technically had no relationship to the school board whatsoever, was elected independent of that, had no direction or control over the educational system. At the time I was elected county judge, we had a relatively conservative and fiscally sound county school board, and we had a quite liberal and fiscally not too sound mm-hmm. city school board. And But the county judge had nothing to do with education in this community whatsoever. So it was really not something other than being a part of the community system that the county had any control over.
What do you recall of the initial stages of this? Like when the lawsuit came down, did you, or you can probably remember what public opinion was, being a public official, you had a pretty good gauge on that, I'm guessing. Well, what was the attitude between the initial suit and when it was inevitable that there was going to be some busing?
Well, it was very interesting because and we can probably place most of the time frame of my involvement in the year 1975, because in the early part of that year, I believe it was the state school board who, in essence, I want to say, forced the merger of this of these two philosophically opposite school boards. One that was affluent and quite conservative, which was the county school board. Was forced to merge with the city school board, which was very liberal and not very secure financially. So what happened was there was this forced merger of these two massive school boards representing two divergent groups of people and being forced together to operate as one. Well, that was fraught with problems to begin with. There had been a federal lawsuit that had been filed some years prior involving only the school boards, had nothing to do with county government. And probably most people at the time who studied that issue never expected a ruling to come down for 2 or 3 years prior to 1975. Or after 1975. And in the spring of that year, as I mentioned, the school boards were forced to merge. And then the Sixth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals, quite unexpectedly, as far as the majority of leadership in this community thought, I believe came down in June or July of 75, mandating the forced integration of these two school boards and ordered massive busing, reversed Judge James Gordon, who was the federal judge handling that matter, and ordering him to implement countywide busing to begin in September of 75. So we went from March of 75, where the state school board forced the merger of these massive school districts. Several months later, the Sixth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals reversed Judge Gordon and ordered him to implement countywide busing. And then several months after that, schools opened. So the time frame to deal with this issue was very short.
So you really had no authority over schools per se. So tell us, what was your, as county judge back then, what in a nutshell, what
I think
was your
people
authority?
people have to understand the nature of a county judge in Kentucky at that time. The county judge was the chief judge over the entire lower court system of the county, and we have 120 counties in this Commonwealth, the difference being if it's Rockcastle County, the county judge might have 4,000 people. The other end of that spectrum is Jefferson County, where I was county judge, where I had nearly 1 million people to deal with. So about 1/4 of Kentucky's population was under the jurisdiction of the Jefferson County judge. It was the only position in America, to our knowledge, where one person was all three branches of American government, because the county judge was the chief judge over the entire lower court system, the system that we today know as the district court system. For an example, today we elect, I think it's 26 district judges. Those people were appointed in my day by the county judge. County judge was also the chief executive over the entire county. And in this county, I had Louisville and 88 other cities that constituted, along with the vast other areas of the county, the population. But the county judge was elected countywide by all of the people in all of those cities and responsible to all of those people. And at the time, Kentucky was one, I believe, of only four states in the nation where county governments had legislative authority. And the county judge was the chairman of the legislative body.
Does that mean the county commission? Was there a county commission?
I had three county commissioners and myself. That four-member body was the legislative body of the county. So the county judge was the chief executive over the entire county. He was the chief judge over the entire county's district court system, and he was chairman of the legislative body.
What was fiscal court? Were you over that too?
Fiscal court was in essence the legislative body. It was a quasi legislative body.
Just for money. Just for financial issues?
The fiscal court had to approve the annual budget of the county. But then the county judge was the chief executive who had responsibility for implementing.
So you presided over when
I presided over
fiscal court. And it wasn't a court like we think of court. It was more council of
that's
sorts.
Correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Okay. Well, in all of that, what responsibilities did you assume or did you feel were coming at you when this busing order was issued and the school was going to start,
The county judge was responsible for running the county police. The county judge was responsible for running the county court system. And the county judge, and this was, again, the only county in the Commonwealth of Kentucky, which has 120 counties, where the operation of the jail was under a professional department of corrections and was run by the county judge. In most counties, you have jailers elected, and they run the jail.
Did you have a sheriff in this county then?
Did have a sheriff.
Elected separately, or did you appoint the sheriff?
Had a sheriff elected separately, but in 1970, the sheriff was Alan Hamilton, who was a very good friend of mine. He had been elected with me on the same ticket. And one of the great problems in this community for 100 years plus was the operation of the jail. It was run back then by the sheriff's department, and it was a public disgrace. And Sheriff Hamilton, and but for Alan Hamilton, this could have never happened, but he went with me to the General Assembly and supported my movement to create a professional Department of Corrections and to take the operation of the jail away from the sheriff's office and put it under county government. So that's how that happened. We created in 1970 a professional Department of Corrections. So that's why the county judge was responsible for operating the jail. Well, you can imagine with the tsunami, as I mentioned to you, the tsunami of all great social upheavals in the history of Kentucky being court-ordered desegregation, there was such civil unrest that it affected the entire community. Well, the one person responsible to the entire community was the county judge. I was the eye of the hurricane. Mm-hmm. You can't keep the peace if you have thousands of people rioting in the streets without a police department, without jails, and without courts. And the county judge ran all of those. So, in addition to everything else that a mayor does.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's why the county judge was the eye of the hurricane through this federal catastrophe.
So when did it become apparent to you that it was going to be violent? I mean, I think the judge ordered it, the plan became pretty public in maybe June or July, like you said.
That's correct.
School starts September 4th.
That's correct.
So when was it, you know, when did you, we know what happened after that and we're going to talk about that, but was there a point when you just kind of could sense that there was going to be a lot of violence and?
Well, people throughout this community were very, very upset that the federal government was telling them, the federal courts, the Supreme Court, telling them what they were going to do with their children. First of all, the majority of people here we're still a southern state, mm-hmm. gateway to the South, and they don't take too kindly to activist judges. This is not a liberal state. And first and foremost, most folks, I think, believe that the federal courts were far exceeding their authority to act in a matter like this. And hundreds, if not thousands, of people who probably had never so much as gotten a traffic ticket were suddenly being ordered by some federal court to as to what they were going to do in the education of their children. And it was a lot tougher on the African-American members of our community than it was on the Caucasian members of our community. Those are the children who were put at the greatest inconvenience. Those were the children who were having to be bused 90% of the time of their educational process in the elementary and secondary levels. And they were also the ones who had to travel the greatest distances on the buses. So they were very compliant with the law.
They being African-American community.
African-American members of our community. But it was a horrible inconvenience on them.
Now, when you talk about the animosity toward the federal government, back when you were actually in high school when the Brown Order came down, how would you compare the feeling, if you can remember, how would you compare the feeling in Louisville then versus the feeling in Louisville in 1975? Was there the same kind of thing in 54 to 56?
Or? I don't feel that there was. I feel that although in other places in Kentucky, I think Governor Happy Chandler was governor at the time, and he had to order the National Guard into Sturgis, Kentucky, and some of those areas. But I don't think there was that feeling in Jefferson County. I don't think people felt like that allowing African-American children to go to any public school was an infringement on their rights. I think people more accepted that
the spirit of Brown versus the order of the busing.
Yeah, they weren't telling. Unlike the 75 decision in 1954, they weren't telling people in this community or in this state where they had to send their children to school. They weren't imposing any great sacrifice on them. Brown said that separate is not equal, and Brown said that black children in America had the right to go to white schools, that there should not be black or white schools, but they didn't tell people where they had to send their kids either. Mm-hmm. So I think there was a completely different atmosphere, as I recall.
Can you, when the anti-busing movement became a little bit more organized, can you maybe recall some of the anti-busing protesters, some of the people, either the leaders or just the masses, either one?
I can recall some. Surely I can. But I don't think anybody in their wildest imagination believed that we would have thousands upon thousands of people in protest and ultimately rioting in the streets. Thank God, in many respects, that most of the major protesting and most of, sadly, the rioting that we had was contained in certain areas of this county, which were predominantly white.
Where were those areas?
Well, primarily the Dixie Highway area out near Valley High School in the far southwestern portions of the county, and the areas out Preston Highway near Southern High School were two areas that come to mind most quickly. They had massive demonstrations of thousands of people and burning cars and rioting and looting, you have to believe that in many of those instances there were just troublemakers out there, but it was telling people where they're going to send their children and how they're going to educate their children is not something they took very kindly to. People here historically don't believe that government is the fix-all answer to society's problems, and resented that and they reacted to it.
What about the leadership in the anti-busing movement? Did they act responsibly, you think?
Some of them did. Others saw it as an opportunity to gain some kind of political traction or establish some kind of political name for themselves. For some elected officials, it was a matter of demonstrating to retain political position. It was very difficult to stand up and take a leadership role at that time.
Did you see it? It seemed like I'd read about some that kind of shifted gears, maybe Julian Carroll Mazzoli. Was that Mazzoli? Was he a congressman?
Congressman Mazzoli was, Ron Mazzoli was in office.
Seemed like I'd read, this is me saying this from what I've read, so correct me if this is wrong, but that they both either were ambivalent or they were okay with the busing, and then there seemed like there was enough of it was clear where public opinion was on this issue. And then they kind of shifted their attitudes toward anti-busing. Is that safe to say, or do you think?
I don't think Congressman Mazzoli thought that busing was the answer. And I don't think Governor Carroll thought busing was the answer. I think they both were very responsible in the positions they took. I worked very closely with Governor Carroll, particularly in terms of public safety and law enforcement. Congressman Mazzoli really, really never got spun into the whole busing issue that much, I don't think.
Okay.
But he, like Governor Carroll and like myself, believed that we should enforce the law. We're a government of laws and not of vigilantes, and it was our responsibility to uphold the law, and if it was going to be changed, to try to change the law, which is what I tried to do. But as long as the law was ordered, then I had to follow those orders.
Okay, a Louisville Defender editorial had praised you, and it said, Judge Hollenbeck made his move to protect the city from overwhelming violence. Did others tend to agree with this statement when all the violence, once the violence subsided, did others tend to agree with that, or did you catch criticism at all?
David, it was very difficult for the vast majority of people in this county to understand where these orders were coming from. They day in and day out, they saw the county judge. They knew who he was. they knew what his responsibilities were. But the average citizen didn't have any concept of where this was coming from. They can't identify with a United States Supreme Court. You know, one of the reasons, the whole concept of busing, which was devised originally as an approach to integration, was conceived by Dr. Lewis Coleman, who was a world-famous sociologist, but he never had any concept of this being used as a judicial tool. He merely proposed it as a consideration for a legislative body, a Congress, to debate. And if a majority of those representing an area in Congress decided that this would be a way to integrate society, then it would be implemented. They never imagined somebody like Thurgood Marshall or a United States Supreme Court suddenly deciding to become judicial activists and deciding that they're going to rule that we're going to have massive integration because we're going to have massive busing across the country. It was never intended to be that way. And in my judgment, it was clearly unconstitutional for the Supreme Court of the United States to involve itself in something that was purely a legislative matter.
Now, I've read where you were going to. Did you travel to D.C. and testify in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee on this anti-busing amendment?
Well, I think Mayor Sloan did.
Okay.
I was too busy here putting out fires.
Had you planned on it? It seemed like I'd read an article that you were going to or something. Is that?
I went to Washington. You know, I was looking for help anywhere we could find it. But I felt that what we had to do was change the law. And of course, it was the Supreme Court of the United States who had mandated this law. And so my feeling was that we needed to pursue through the court system to change this law. And I think had you had the massive busing of children throughout the country, that you would have had a constitutional amendment prohibiting busing passed by the vast majority of the people in this country.
And the only reason that didn't happen is because it was selected cities.
That's
where
right.
This was going,
you know,
on.
They selected Boston, they selected Louisville, they selected a handful of cities across the country and to make examples out of them.
Mm-hmm.
But didn't make it right, but they did it.
Now, you ran for governor on the Democratic in the Democratic primary in 75, is that correct?
I did.
And you lost to Julian Carroll.
I did.
Now, how did did busing or desegregation come up at all
no,
in that primary?
No,
okay.
It was not an issue in that primary.
Okay. What do you remember it being an issue? I guess did you come over to Carroll's side, endorse him before that was over with, or were you involved with the?
Well, he was elected in November of 75, so it never scathed him in that election.
Okay.
You know,
his opponents seemed to try to make it. I read some press releases. This was a guy named Gable, Robert Gable. He seemed to try to cast Carroll as part of the busing problem from some things I'd read. Do you recall that being very big, or am I just reading the occasion?
I don't think it ever had any traction. I know I told Governor Carroll that I'd be for him or against him, whichever would help him the most.
okay, now, you did sponsor a conference. You brought some people in here. Was it Robert Coleman or Lewis? You said Lewis Coleman. His name's not Robert Coleman. Am I getting him mixed up with somebody else, maybe?
I think it was Dr. Lewis Coleman.
Okay. But you brought some people in.
Well, what my approach, one of my approaches, since this federal court order was having such an adverse effect on this entire community. And the school board, in my judgment, had put together a busing plan that was a catastrophe. I felt that it was my obligation to seek to devise an alternative plan. And in to do this, I felt it was important to get the finest minds in the country to put together a plan that not only was workable, but that was constitutional. And I hired Dr. Philip Curlin, who was probably the foremost constitutional scholar in America at the time, and Dr. Lewis Coleman to put together a plan that would survive the constitutional muster and that would provide a reasonable alternative plan to the catastrophic plan that this school board, the makeup of which I described to you, half of it extremely liberal, half of it extremely conservative, and totally incompatible, had put together, which was a joke. And we went before the federal court and filed to intervene, explaining to the federal court that, you know, this was having such a massive negative impact on this entire community that we had a right, because of our responsibilities for public safety, to intervene, and was granted intervention by Federal Judge Gordon. And our plan was the plan that proposed voluntary busing, that proposed magnet schools, that proposed traditional schools, that proposed everything that was finally accepted some 25 years later.
Suit a little bit.
Well, anyway, I prepared a petition to intervene and went before Judge Gordon and had all of the facts and all of the figures and all of the necessary information to show to Judge Gordon that, first of all, there needed to be a responsible alternative plan to be offered that could be approved by him as the federal judge, and one that was voluntary, and one that would achieve the rightful goals of what he was trying to do, and to show the incredible negative impact that his order and this other plan was having on this community. It was unlike anything anybody had ever seen anywhere. As I mentioned to you, David, it was the tsunami of failed social experiments, and that's what it was. And if you look statistically today at the honest facts and statistics here 35 years after its implementation, or 31 years, you'll see that it has achieved nothing. It has cost hundreds of millions of dollars in wasted monies, and there's been no improvement. And in my judgment, and I may be wrong, but I think the Supreme Court, having recently agreed to rehear this case after all these years, will settle on that side, that it shouldn't have come about and it hasn't achieved anything.
Now, you say Gordon allowed you to intervene, he allowed the intervention. Does that just mean that he heard you out? Because nothing,
no,
he didn't change, did he?
No,
nothing.
We filed. We became a party in that action, and we took a plan all the way up.
All the way up to the Sixth Circuit? Okay.
Which was rejected, but there wasn't anything that was going to be accepted at that point in period in history. The Supreme Court had made a decision, right or wrong, they were going to stick by it. It was a very liberal court. But there were such things that I pointed out to Judge Gordon. We had, as I mentioned, there were really three school districts. We had the city school district, which was essentially bankrupt. and we had the very affluent county school district, and then we had a third school district called Anchorage. Anchorage was then and is now the most racially segregated school district in the United States of America. And I say that because they had no black children, number one, and they, in drawing those school boundaries for the Anchorage school system, had two areas, one called Berrytown and one called Griffeytown. And Berrytown and Griffeytown had been for years where the black servants of the people who lived in Anchorage lived. And when they drew the Anchorage school districts, they gerrymandered both Berrytown and Griffeytown out of the Anchorage school district,
leaving them up to the county. That meant they would automatically be in the county district way
correct.
Back there.
That is correct.
Prior to Brown,
but
anyway.
Berrytown and Griffeytown both adjoined, physically adjoined Anchorage. So it wasn't like they lived 20 miles away, but that's where
were they part of Anchorage? Were they within the city limits of Anchorage, or just adjacent to Anchorage?
They were adjacent to Anchorage.
Okay.
When they drew the Anchorage school district, they gerrymandered both of those black areas out of the Anchorage school district.
And this district still exists
it
today?
Does.
And it's still called Anchorage
and
school
still,
district?
And it's still, and then was the most affluent residential area of all of Jefferson County, and still is one of the more affluent, if not the most affluent.
Now today it's its own, it's all one city, correct? But there's just a little independent school district there. Is that how that works?
Well, we have a metropolitan government now.
Right.
But we still have retained a number of cities.
That have
smaller cities.
That have a mayor or what have you? Okay.
Mayor, their own police force.
Oh, is that right? Okay, I didn't realize. I thought it was all one
It's
not quite one happy family.
No, we have one central government now, but we still have retained, and this was the only way they could get merger passed. We have retained probably, I would imagine there's still 60 or 70 cities.
Really?
In
okay.
Jefferson County, yeah.
Now, how would you characterize the Courier-Journal's reporting during the mid-70s over this issue?
Anything but neutral. They were strong, strong advocates for this social engineering. They were great proponents of busing. The Bingham family historically had been very liberal and very, very much in the active forefront of social engineering.
Let's talk about Judge Gordon a little bit. If you would just maybe describe him a little bit. Did you ever litigate in his court before any of this happened as just a private attorney?
Yeah. I mean, that not much, because I wasn't a private attorney very long before I became county judge. But
yeah, he became judge, I think, about the time you graduated law school.
Correct.
Okay.
And I knew Judge Gordon, liked Judge Gordon. Didn't see eye to eye on Judge Gordon after he was mandated by the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals to reverse himself. I often believe that he just moved 180 degrees. He had originally ruled against busing, and then he was mandated by the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals to implement not only busing, but countywide busing of a very massive nature, and he followed their orders too much.
Well, give me a little bit more about Gordon, personality-wise. How did he run a courtroom?
Oh, he ran a courtroom. It was his courtroom. He was a tough old bird. Had a great sense of humor, but you didn't cross him. I know several times when I was presenting before him during this busing issue, I thought he was going to throw me in court for contempt, particularly when I pointed out to him that he had ordered this massive plan of busing, but at the same time, he had exempted the most racially segregated school district in America. I don't think he took too kindly to me pointing that out to the world. But he was a good judge. I didn't agree with him on this issue. But then I wasn't in his position.
Did he have a reputation before any of this ever came down amongst the citizenry? Or amongst the legal community?
I mean, well, he was well thought of in the legal community, and should have been. He was a good, tough judge. But I always felt, David, that he went after having been overruled by his superiors, I felt he went ballistic. He went overboard.
Mm-hmm. What kind of attitude did he receive from people after he did, I guess, capitulate or follow his superiors? I mean, once this became Gordon's order, you know, how did the community treat him?
Well,
or did they?
The vast majority didn't think too kindly of him. The ultra liberals probably thought he was some kind of deity.
Okay. How did the black community express their feelings on this issue, if at all? And how, to you, you know, as being the county judge, the head lawman of the county, or whatever?
They were.
Did they express their position?
I spent many an evening going to black churches and speaking with the congregations and speaking with the black members of our community and the leadership of our community. And they were focused on trying to find a better life for their children and their children's children, and rightfully they should have been. I think they had been told by many members of the white liberal community that this was going to be the be-all, end-all of educational opportunity for the black children of this community and of this country. They were being told that by the know-it-all social engineers. I went to meet with them, as I did with members of labor, as I did with members of the blue collar community and the more affluent white collar community, to be there to listen to them, to inform them, and the members of our black community probably were the most abiding citizens we had during that era. They were respectful, they were polite, they were committed, but they were committed to one, obey the law, and two, to find a better life for their children and their society.
Did the, I have to agree with what you're, some of the things you're saying for sure. The elite, the NAACP, the American Civil Liberties Union, was a minority voice in this, but they used the courts and they got this taken care of.
Yeah.
And did they convince, you're saying that those, that group, I think you didn't cite those groups, but I'm guessing that's what you meant. Those groups convinced the blacks that this busing was the solution. Were the blacks convinced of that, do you think? I mean, they obviously accepted.
In my judgment, David, they did not know. They were being told that this was going to provide a better education for their children. And there was no proof of that. There was no evidence of that. And they were hopeful, so they wanted to believe. And I respect that. But my great concern was making sure that there was no child, black or white, who felt threatened through this, and that there was no citizen in this massive county who didn't at least feel like someone was listening to them. And to that end, I mentioned to you, I'd go to meetings, David, where there'd be thousands of people show up. And at that point in time, none of them liked me. But I was the only consistently visible leader in this community who went to them. I thought growing up as an athlete and playing a lot of sports and being what I hoped was a guy's guy, man's man, that I'd heard about every name called a person that existed until busing, and I was called a few that I'd never heard before. But I put myself out in the light. I felt it was important for me. I didn't run from the issue. And most of the hostility was in the outlying areas of the county, and not so much in the city of Louisville. My greatest fear during this whole period of time was that, thank God, if there were going to be riots, they were out in the county because that was all white. And my great concern was that you could have racial tensions. And I know when we designed the plan to provide the law enforcement, which we knew would be necessary in this county, and to provide the safety that was necessary, particularly for the children, that if there was a need for backup in this county, that it would be the state police who would come in and not the city police, because my feeling was, and Governor Carroll's feeling was too, that the if all hell broke loose in the city, that's when it would become very racial. And every city police officer was necessary to be rested and prepared and to provide the security within the city. And I know that there was a time when the city police were wondering why they weren't called in to help in the county. And I know Mayor Sloan got a little upset about it. But I told him simply, you know, our great concern about problems would be if this erupts into racial warfare. And the city police are needed to maintain the peace in the city. And thank goodness, if there were going to be riots, they happened in the county, and the state police and the county police dealt with that.
And it was almost strictly white people rioting with each other, yeah. I guess, or just demonstration.
Demonstrating.
And then the police try to put it down, and then it gets out of control.
Well, it'd get out of control when they started looting and
but those riots that I've read about were almost, like you said, it was almost strictly white
folks. That's correct.
Demonstrating, and then mob mentality takes over.
And troublemakers coming from the outside.
Right. Know. Right.
Yeah.
At one point, Judge Gordon was critical of was McDaniel your safety?
He was my chief of police.
Chief of county police. At one point, Gordon was critical of him for not putting down a riot. You know, was that fair criticism, or is this Gordon looking at this from behind a bench? Or
it was not fair criticism. Everything's possible for the man who doesn't have to do it. And Judge Gordon didn't have to do it. Colonel McDaniel had to do it. And Judge Gordon, fine a judge as he might have been in many respects, would have been catastrophic had he been chief of police.
I think you've answered this one, but did you or your staff predict that violence would erupt in particular parts of the city? You've told me where it was larger, parts of the county, I should say. Was there any precautions you guys took in certain areas, or did you place anybody in certain...
David, we took a lot of precautions, but I met with my county police, and I must say an outstanding young police force, ranked one of the top metropolitan forces in the country. Force was so good, I had about 50 state troopers transfer to my county police department during my terms in office. But I, in dealing with this issue, I told them, I said, these are your neighbors. These are people who have never violated a law in their life. These are people who are horribly upset with this thing called the United States Supreme Court. They don't know what it is. They can't relate to it. And I want you to be so understanding with these people that for someone to be arrested, I want them to almost arrest themselves. Meaning, these are your neighbors. Don't be out here beating them in the head. Now, unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to talk to the state police, because when the riots broke out and the governor sent the state police in here, they were used to dealing with people in a different way. And that's when the billy clubs came out and there were a lot of injuries. There are those who criticize and saying we weren't prepared, but we were not prepared to go in there as law enforcement and beat up the citizenry. We handled it.
State police just took a more aggressive approach?
Oh, yeah.
To what degree was the Ku Klux Klan a force in this anti-busing movement? And had they appeared in the intervening years, you know, from 1954 or 56 when integration started around here till 75, and was the Klan very present at all?
They tried to be. They weren't. There's no history of presence of the Ku Klux Klan in this county. Nor did we want them ever in this county. But, you know, they were attracted, as they normally are, with an issue of this nature, that they see some potential for racial conflict. It seems to attract them like a magnet. So they came in here, but they weren't people from here.
Out of county?
That's correct.
Far out, or just maybe?
You don't have
Kentucky.
To go too far.
Right. Okay. You won your first election as county judge, defeating the incumbent by 4,000 votes. The Encyclopedia of Louisville calls your first term, quote, one of the most innovative and progressive in the country's history. Decreasing, end quote, decreasing crime, enforcing pollution laws, making government more transparent and accessible. You cut property taxes by 5%. You won your second term by nearly 54,000 votes. What happened in your third election? And how did this busing and desegregation play into that? That's mainly why I'm asking that question.
Well, I had a young county trooper say to me some years after busing, he said, Judge, you led us through the greatest catastrophe in the history of Kentucky without a single death except yours politically. Having to stand up to and enforce the law and lead this community through court-ordered busing, probably effectively ended my political career. In fact, our poll showed that in 1977, when I lost by a handful of votes to Mitch McConnell, that had it not been for busing, McConnell would not have come within 45,000 votes of me. So, because there were about 50,000 people, 52,000 people in that poll who said they voted not for McConnell, but against me. They didn't even know who McConnell was. So a fella said to me one time, he said it would have been a setback for Christianity had Christ himself been running for a third term under the name of Todd Hollenbach.
One of the anti-busing leaders who I read about and who you had mentioned to me earlier, his quote was, let's vote the ends out. And it didn't make much sense to me, that phrase alone, without considering what the ends were doing. You know, your forum, you clearly stood against it's clear what you're saying now where you stood then. And it's clear from the papers where you stood then.
Correct.
But that was just the mentality. I guess you're telling me that the mentality of the electorate was, things are bad, will vote out the incumbent.
They were just lashing out.
Yeah, they incumbent. We'll hold the incumbents responsible for this.
It was an era in history and an issue in history that the county judge had absolutely nothing to do with in bringing it about.
Other than trying to protect people when it's going on.
That's correct. But people were so mad at government that it was the great underwriting issue in the 77 campaign.
One other thing I'd read today about the private school busing, there was some decision in fiscal court, I believe. Did fiscal court fund some of the private school busing? Was that normal? What was that about?
We did. Probably 30%+ of the people in this county are Roman Catholic. And we have a massive private school program in this community, not just Catholic schools, but private secular schools. And so there had been a history before my time in office of county government contributing to the transportation needs.
Was that common practice before the busing, before the suit ever happened? That's correct.
And okay. It was based on, there has never been any contribution by government to the education of private school children. But the safety, it was based on the safety needs when you had 40,000 private school children in this community, all of whose parents pay taxes. It had been decided long prior to my administration and by both Democrat and Republican administrations that county government had a responsibility to the public safety needs of those 30 or 40,000 children to provide for their safety through adequate transportation. So that's the history, David, of why in Jefferson County there had been transportation money allocated for private school children. Because of the massive nature of the population of the private schools in this community. And we had been doing that for below those many years.
So did the busing suit even, am I just on, is this another topic that I'm confused about? I just read some headlines earlier.
No, not. It became somewhat of an issue because of the tremendous number of public school parents who were trying to get their children into private schools.
So it was a matter of they needed more money to finance the busing after the, to finance the private school busing after.
Well, I think it became an issue when the public schools were looking for more money, because this has been a horrendously costly social experiment over the last 31 years. I don't have these figures available, but I think the busing of our children alone cost about $70 million a year now, and has over the past years. I mean, that's an incredible amount of money, particularly going to a wasted social experience.
This is just my final question here. As an onlooker, you were also a later public official. Were you Commonwealth's attorney?
I was.
Elected Commonwealth's attorney, just a community person. Looking back on this situation, you know, how would you sum up the story, and would you have done anything different in your capacity as county judge?
So I could have run from it like most other elected officials and maybe survived, but I wasn't elected to run from anything. And I did what I felt I had to do, and I knew the probable consequences of it for me and for my career politically. I don't think I would have done much differently than I did. I thought it was wrong then. I think wrong now. I don't think it's achieved anything in reality for this community or for its children. I don't think it has at all benefited our educational system or benefited any segment of our society. Interestingly enough, there have been black parents who have filed federal actions to try to set it aside because they realize that it's that they were sold a pig and a poke. But looking back on it, I wish it hadn't have happened. I think it we could have achieved far more in terms of educating all of our children in this county to a much greater degree with far greater benefit than we've seen. I think it has been, if anything, a terribly disruptive episode in the history of this Commonwealth in this county.
Okay, well, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time today.